On Tuesday night, McGill Law hosted a panel about a part of the justice system that often escapes the public eye. More than 12,000 people are currently serving in federal prisons, and many are put to work in jobs in kitchens, maintenance, manufacturing, all for well under minimum wage. That's because prisoners are not legally recognized as employees, which means they lack the basic legal protections that other workers get. Jeff Ewart and Asaf Rashid are trying to change that. Ewart is president of the Canadian Prisoners Labor Confederation. They are working on a charter challenge to get federal prison workers unionized. Rashid is a criminal justice lawyer and co-author of the book Solidarity Beyond Bars. They stopped by CKUT on their way to speak at McGill Law's annual Prue Lecture to talk about the movement to unionize prison labor. Here's our conversation. You know, for people who might be surprised that we have a prison labor population in Canada, at the most basic level, you know, how common is it for somebody who is incarcerated to work a job in prison? You know, what is the actual state of prison labor in this country for listeners who might not know what's going on behind bars?
Well, as far as the federal prison population goes, most federal prisoners, and those are those who are serving sentences of at least 2 years, most actually work. They do some form of employment. And you think of, there's a couple of categories. One is basically institutional maintenance, and that is reproducing the prison. That's what I'll call it, where they're doing the cooking, the cleaning, the maintenance, and all other kinds of work that are day-to-day required that allow the prisons to function. And there's a whole other aspect of work in the federal prisons that's part of an operation called CORCAN, and that's the more business side of the Canadian prison labor industry, and they're doing production work. They're making textiles, furniture, doing other sorts of production work. During COVID-19, they made PPE, for example. Where do the products go that they make? They're purchased by other government departments. Prisoners are not recognized as employees. That's a legal category. What that means is that they don't have the basic protection of at least having a minimum wage, basic health and safety protections that cover all other employees. And very importantly, they don't have the right to unionize because they're not recognized as employees.
Jeff, you're one of the co-founders of CONFED, the Canadian Prisoners Labor Confederation. What was it in your own experience that made you want to start a prisoners' union?
Well, it was not just the labor situation, it's everything to do with prison. Like, because prisoners live where we work, absolutely everything that we do is labor-related. Like, for example, you're sleeping and a guard shines a halogen flashlight in your face at 1 o'clock in the morning and wakes you up. Now you're tired at work and you go to work and you're working around a very dangerous pneumatic press that doesn't have proper safety features on it and you lose a piece of your finger. So prisoners have a lot of concerns about, like, the way they're treated even, just the way the guards talk to us, you know, like... There's a power differential that's unlike anything in modern society. And it's very dehumanizing and very demeaning. There's so many ways that it's abusive that I was sitting with my friend there, David Joel Levette, and we were talking about all these issues that affect us. And the idea just popped in my head, you know, we should form a union because we believe that would then balance the power and just to be treated fairly, you know. Because if we weren't doing the jobs that we're doing, like mowing the lawn, shoveling the snow, cooking the food in the kitchens, cleaning the ranges, taking out the garbage, they'd have to have citizens come in and do those jobs, and they'd be paid a proper wage, and they would be called jobs. Their wages would be called wages, and their jobs would be called jobs. Our jobs are called participation in programs, and our wages are called an allowance to incentivize the participation in rehabilitative programs. But there's nothing rehabilitative about unplugging toilets or, you know, shoveling snow, really. I mean, I don't see that. What's rehabilitative is having self-worth and feeling like your work is meant something and means something. And also that prisoners, you know, they do decades in prison sometimes. And then they get out after making $5 a day for decades, which you can't buy much. And you put money on your phone card so you can phone your family. You got stamps and envelopes to keep in contact with your family, community ties. You don't have much left. You can't save for your release. You can't do that. And so guys are getting out of prison with nothing. What do? They turn back to crime. And that's what society should be concerned about. The atrocious recidivism rate in Canada. We're talking like the general recidivism rate, I think it's still like 86%. It's been static my entire sentence, which has been several decades. if CSC was correcting anything, one would expect the recidivism rate to be improving over all these years, but it doesn't. It just stays status quo. And I think the problem is that people are getting out with no job skills, no money, and they resorted to crime and coming back. And it's the whole thing's a mess. But if you taught people good job skills, paid them a proper wage, you're actually preparing them for release. And I think that would be the key. So that's where this came from.
And what are the kind of jobs that you've worked yourself when you were incarcerated? Can you tell me a bit day-to-day on the job? What are some things that you've experienced?
Well, I mean, I worked in the Cork County Industries back before the Harper government took away the bonus pay and the incentive pay. The top pay level is $690 a day. So after your mandatory deductions, you're left with $52.50 after 10 days on $690. And the Harper government did all the cutbacks. I left. But before that, I was doing such things as making barriers for construction sites. You take boards and then you hammer them together with this big mallet, these little metal brackets with spikes in them that connect the... Anyways, it's really... A monkey could do it, okay? It's just brute force. You just do that all day and it's just hard work. But it's not a skill. A lot of the stuff that people do in Corkan, a monkey could do. Literally, a monkey could do it. I've worked in printing operations where we printed file folders for various government departments. And guys are sitting at a table after the file folders are printed. They're folding the file folders and putting them in a box, putting those little, I don't know what you call them, those little metal tong things they stick through and to fasten them together. And then a white sticker on the back to hold it in place. And you just do this mundane thing all day long. It's not rehabilitative. It's very dehumanizing. It's demeaning. And it's very boring. But the RCMP file folder contract was $1.5 million. You know, I mean, they're making a lot of money off this. Like, we're subsidizing our own incarceration.
Both of you have spoken about the fact that, you know, prisoners are not getting the same protections as other workers. Why, I guess, in our legal regime, are prisoners not treated as employees? I understand why it might make sense to get subsidized labor in a prison if you're looking at, you know, the dollars and cents of it. But how did we get to this point where you can be doing work and not be considered a worker?
From my experience, the Correctional Services of Canada gets more and more sophisticated the more challenges there are in court. And there was a case some time ago. It was a fellow that was, he was trying to be a CSIS employee. He was in the program. He did his, you know, he did his firearms training. He did his hand-to-hand combat training. Now he's in languages training, and he's got to complete this last thing before he can be a CSIS employee. And he applied to be a member of the union. And the ruling was, you cannot be a member of a union if you're in a program. And around that time, CSC changed the name of the work board to the programs board.
CSC being?
Correctional Services of Canada. So now we have a programs board. And they changed the name. We're not working. We're involved in rehabilitative programs. So it's semantics, right? So then they say, and our pay isn't pay. There's a whole CD, a commissioner's directive on inmate pay. It's called inmate pay. That's what the CD is called. But yet, when it comes to these legal challenges, the Treasury Board argues it's not pay. It's an allowance to incentivize the participation in the said rehabilitative programs. Now, there are rehabilitative programs. I don't know how much rehabilitation takes place in these programs, but these are like therapeutic interventions. It's completely different than what the work we do. Mopping a floor does not do that. Shoveling snow does not do it. Mowing the grass does not. Folding file folders doesn't do that. But it has been shown that, because back in the day, prior to all this nonsense, people actually had real good jobs in prison. There was welding. Guys could get welding tickets. They could, you know, they could learn plumbing, how to do plumbing stuff. They could get tickets. And they got out and they did really well. There was even auto mechanics. They'd have a car in there and people would be like taking apart engines and putting it back together again. Like you could learn a skill that is employable in the community. And these guys weren't coming back. And then it all changed. They got into this, the whole philosophy of corrections and what they're trying to do with people, rehabilitate them, you know?
You said under the Harper government around 2013, the structure of prisoner pay changed. Is that when you and your friend at the time decided to launch these legal challenges?
No, it was way before that. Although the legal challenge happened in 2014, it was just a coincidence. David Joel Levitt and I had these discussions in 2004 in Mission Institution. And then we both got involuntarily transferred out of the institution for different reasons. I'm not saying there were good reasons, but we were both transferred out. I went to a maximum security penitentiary. He went to a medium security penitentiary. And I sort of sort of forgot about it, you know, because we're not together now. And, you know, I'm in a max and it's really tight there. And he was in this medium, and but he kept the idea in his head, and he started talking to people about it and started kind of getting some momentum behind it. And he contacted me, and I said, okay. So I started writing the constitutions, right? Because you got to have a constitution if you're going to file an unfair labor practices complaint. And then there was a riot in the institution he was in, and somebody got murdered, and he got shipped out. He came to where I was, so we were back together again. And that's when we started, well, 2009, that's when that happened. He came back to Kent, Max. So we started putting it together, and we asked the warden for permission to have a meeting, a general population meeting in the gym, and for the purpose of organizing. And of course they said no, and that's a violation of a charter, section 2D, freedom of association. So we filed an unfair labor practices complaint before what was then called the Public Service Labor Relations Board.
And so since then, you have been filing various legal complaints, building up this case that now is taking the form of a charter challenge. Is that right? Can you tell me more about where your legal challenge stands today, what you're trying to do in 2025, you know, more than 15 years after you guys started working on this union?
Okay, so 2012, I wrote written submissions to the PSLRB on the first unfair labor practices complaint. And of course, we were denied. And I told Dave, we're going to be denied, we're going to lose, and we're going to lose in federal court. And in 2014, I argued what was then called Jolivet versus Treasury Board, because he was the front guy. And of course, that was before the Federal Court of Appeal, and we lost. But what I told Dave is we're going to attract lawyers. And at that time, a law firm called Cavalluzzo, Shilton, McIntyre & Cornish in Toronto, it's a very large labor law firm, contacted me. Dave, he disappeared. He got out in 2012, and I haven't heard from him since. So they've been with me for the past 11 years now, pro bono. They believe in this. And there's a good lawyer down there, Ryan White, and his associate, Deborah Gruderman, and they're working very hard. And yeah, we went before the board. The Treasury Board is the respondent, because that's who runs and operates CORCAN. That's where our money comes from. We're paid by the Treasury Board. And there's a provision in the Act that says if you work for the Crown, you can't be a member of a union, if I'm correct. So that same provision prevented the RCMP from unionizing. And then they did a charter challenge and they won. So ironically, it looks like the RCMP have paved the way for us.
So you guys are doing a charter challenge too. What is it in the charter that you are using to contest this?
Well, the main charter argument that's used universally with these types of things is 2D, freedom of association. But there's a couple others I've been talking with Ryan and Deborah about. There's one section 6.2b. Under 6 is the freedom of mobility, the right for the citizen to move anywhere in the province of Canada, take up residence in any province of Canada. But section 6.2b says every citizen of Canada has the right to earn a livelihood. And so that, nobody's argued this before, because people who work earn a livelihood. But we work, but we can't earn a livelihood at $5 a day. And we can't help our families, and we can't prepare ourselves for release. So I suggested to Ryan and Deborah that we look at adding that charter argument.
And yeah, you talked about filing these challenges from behind bars. What was that like, just to, you know, start out, you and your friend, without any lawyers as of yet? You said you got this pro bono legal support after coming out with these challenges, but you still had to like figure out how the legal system worked and like go through the complex and arduous task over years of starting this process. What was that like, and what is it like now to be doing this constitutional challenge with that support that you got by putting forward all these different board challenges over the years?
You know, it was necessary. It was necessary to learn, because again, we don't make much money, so we don't have the money to hire lawyers. If you're getting $5 a day, you can barely buy a bag of chips at the end of your pay period after you paid for your cable and everything else and your family needs and stuff, like your phone calls and stuff. So if you're gonna complain about something, do something about it. And so I just hit the books and started trying to learn how to navigate my way through federal court. And yeah, that's where we got. You have to do it, because they're not going to do it for you. Lawyers aren't just going to come running to you and say, well, I'll do this case for nothing. So I just had to learn how to do it myself. And that's where it started for me. It's been weird.
Asaf, I want to ask you, what support is there for this kind of initiative in Canada? You argued that prisoners need unionization in your book. When you were doing the research for that book, what did you find about just what precedents are there and what kind of, I guess, movement this could be a part of?
Well, there was an actual union of prisoners back in the late 70s and early 80s at the Guelph. There's a Guelph Correctional Center, provincial prison in Guelph. They were abattoir workers, and they worked alongside non-incarcerated workers, and they were together in a union, and that lasted for a number of years. So that's the only example in Canadian history where prisoners were actually unionized and is in a provincial setting. But as far as right now, like what the issue is, why should people care? Well, the thing is, there's this mistaken kind of identification of prisoners as somehow being entirely separate from the rest of society, that they don't have any connection with others, including other workers, in fact, not even recognized as employees. Well, actually, there are a lot of others who face a similar situation where they are treated quite horribly in society, such as, for example, migrant farm workers under the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program. They are forced to live on the site of their employer. They are on closed work permits. And if they have a problem with their boss can just fire them and then they get deported. So there are other workers who are in a very vulnerable situation. So we're arguing in the book that people should see commonality between other groups of workers who are also on very marginalized positions and prisoners. There's also a lot of other workers who have not had employee recognition either. We think of gig economy workers. They were told you're independent contractors, non-employees. So this is another group of workers who also, they've been denied the category of employee recognition. Therefore, without that category, they're not protected by basic minimum employment standards, being treated like an independent contractor, as if they're running their own business. Therefore, they get underpaid, they get poorly treated, etc. There's also unpaid interns in Canada as well. It's a huge problem. This was supposed to have been banned in Canada. That was talked about in 2015. The federal government talked about banning unpaid internships. They didn't ban them. So what we want to see is drawing the lines between other groups of workers and prisoners for something called an inclusive labor movement. So people should care about this, especially now when it's more important perhaps than ever for the labor movement to be more organized as we're facing all these tariff threats, which with the likely consequences of the Canadian state seeking to find ways to increase corporate profits. So we'll be seeing pressures to lower wages, even we're going to see cutting of social programs, an austerity agenda rollout, and that's going to put a lot of pressure on workers, particularly lower income workers, and it's going to be more and more important to be organized to fight back against that. And you can't have workers who are not even considered employees who are denied the right to unionization. That's not going to help when it comes to the labor movement needing to fight back as strong as ever.
I think it's important that we succeed in this, because I think it'd be inspirational for other people in other situations, like the migrant workers, like these other workers that we've been discussing, to see that even lowly prisoners can get their act together and fight against this monstrosity, which is government oppression, and win. And I think if we win, I think that'll inspire others to say, hey, you know, we can do this too. And I think that would help. I think it would really. So root for us, get behind us and support us. We'll support you.
To sort of close off, I wanted to ask you both, what is really at stake here? You know, how would this change people's lives, specifically the lives of people who are incarcerated, if this case succeeds?
There's a really crucial piece of prisoner unionization where if prisoners were successful, and I think in this case, I have hope that they will be this time around, that what'll end up happening is that you will have the fact of unionization. And that would mean that prisoners would have the right to sit across a bargaining table with the employer. Who's the employer? Well, it's Correctional Service of Canada in the case of federal prisons. It's not just their employer, it's also their jailer. So it opens the door to a whole number of other issues. The living conditions and the working conditions are inseparable. It gives the opportunity to bring a lot to the table, and it could be a game changer in terms of power dynamics, because you suddenly have the protection of labor law, this charter, Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms power to compel the government to negotiate in good faith. And it has to be meaningful collective bargaining. There are all these terms that apply to all employees across the country when they're unionized, and you'd have the Correctional Service of Canada being stuck having to deal with that legal weight that's behind the power to sit at a bargaining table across from them as prisoners will be doing. So the possibilities are enormous in terms of what can be gained, even the possibility of better work programs to be able to be in a better position to be released and stay out. Possibly it could lead to even decarceration, because you'll have prisoners needing to get paid more, being treated better. It becomes more costly for the prisons to maintain large populations. If people are doing well and being paid well in their jobs in prison, perhaps say they could be on a road to quicker release, because the government simply can't afford to keep them in for much longer.
So a lot could change, basically. Jeff, what are you hoping will change?
Everything's going to change. This is going to be, like as you said, a game changer. I just wanted to point out that we're not the only ones on the panel tonight. There's going to be the co-author of the book, Solid Liberty Beyond Bars. His name is Jordan House. He's a professor of labor law studies at Brock University. There's going to be correctional investigator Ivan Zinger. There's going to be Deborah Gudeman. She's a lawyer out of Cavaluzzo that I referred to earlier. And then, of course, our host and moderator, Professor Jeff Kennedy. So there'll be six of us on the panel. It's my understanding, and I'm new at this, I've never been involved in any union activities. We haven't succeeded yet, so it's not a union yet. But it's my understanding that it's illegal to interfere with the lawful activities of a union. So once we are a union, if we're doing something lawfully, you cannot interfere with us. And if you interfere with us, then a mediator can be brought in from the labor board. And we can, as he said, collectively bargain and negotiate for changes or improvements, right? And it changes the whole conversation. The inmate grievance procedure that we presently have, I hate that word inmate, but that's what they call it. Oh no, they changed it. They call it offender complaint. I hate that name too. Complaint and grievance system is absolutely useless. It's a waste of money and time, and it's designed to frustrate prisoners so they just give up. That will be gone. We form a union. Our disputes will be dealt with in an adult fashion with professional people that are actually good at what they do, and it'll be fair. So that's a big one. Prisoners, there's a lot of prisoners that want to give back to society. We've taken from society, and some of us feel bad about that. Not everybody, but some of us do, and we want to give back, and this is a way to do it. It's not well known, but our Constitution has a provision for a victim's assistance fund. See, prisoners who get out of prison, they have a parole condition, almost universally a parole condition, no contact, direct or indirect, with your victims, or your families or your victims. So say, for example, a prisoner gets out and wins the lottery. He can't even do anything to help out the families of his victims, because that would be a violation of his release conditions, and he could be revoked and brought back to prison. But if we had a general labor union victims fund, and there was, you know, some coffers there that the board of directors of the union would decide on their own who they're going to help out, it would be independent of any prisoners, and nobody would be violating any conditions. So say, for example, some woman, she's a single mother, and her car gets stolen, and she can't get to work, and she can't drop her kids off. And this hits the news, and it's a sad story, but it's, you know, on the local news. And the board of directors of our union says, you know what, let's help that woman out. And they just make a decision to give her $30,000 for a car, or 10, or whatever it is for a car. I don't know what cars cost these days. These kinds of things. This is something that would be really good. But also, we'd be paying into workmen's compensation, so we could have compensation for our injuries. We'd be paying taxes, income taxes. We pay sales taxes on what we purchase, but we can't collect tax rebates because we don't pay income tax. Because we don't get income, we get incentives for participation in programs, right? We'd be paying into, like, registered retirement savings plans. If we got out, we could actually do that. We'd be paying EI. So if a guy gets out of prison and he hasn't got a job right away, he could collect EI because he's been paying into it, you see. So this would stimulate the economy when you're talking about thousands of prisoners across Canada. Yeah, this is going to change everything.
Jeff and Asaf, thank you both for coming on CKUT.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Jeff Ewart and Asaf Rashid. Ewart is president of the Canadian Prisoners Labor Confederation. Rashid is a criminal justice lawyer and co-author of the book Solidarity Beyond Bars. For CKUT, I'm Jules Bujal with the Local Journalism Initiative.